This episode contains strong language. Please be advised.
It's a summer night in 1955, and Marilyn tosses and turns in bed. By the end of the day, she's so shaky with exhaustion, it starts to feel like adrenaline. She's been starting her days with private sessions with the acting guru, Lee Strasberg. He takes a strict approach to acting. You can't act unless you feel the scene. Dig deep into your past. And then in the evenings, she trundles from Lee's apartment to her psychotherapist on the Upper East Side. Lee recommends that everyone who's serious about method acting also pursue therapy. And Marilyn is very, very serious. So she visits Dr. Margaret Hohenberg 5 times a week. Dr. Hohenberg sits in a chair with a pen and paper, while Marilyn lies back on the couch. She talks about all the things she's tried so hard not to think about. Her father, who never accepted her, her mother's breakdowns, the foster families who made her feel safe until they also abandoned her. By the time she crawls into bed, she feels like she's on the verge of a nervous collapse. It's exhausting. She's probably pushing herself too hard, but she can't stop now. She's promised the world a new Marilyn. She's sworn she has what it takes to play serious parts. Her best friend, Milton Green, put his own money into their new production company. Lee Strasberg is coaching her for free because that's how much he believes in her. She looks at the clock, 3:12 a.m. She reaches for her sleeping pills, then hesitates. How many has she taken tonight? But she isn't tired in the slightest. She reaches for the bottle and taps out 3 pills, then gulps them down with water. As she falls asleep, she remembers she'd only just taken a handful an hour ago. But it's too late to do anything about that now. Sleep tugs her toward it, and she doesn't resist. She lets her eyes close. And when she wakes up again, she's on a hospital stretcher. Fluorescent lights whiz by overhead.
Okay, what is happening?
Marilyn's also trying to figure that out. She overhears doctors and nurses say something about emergency surgery. She's being wheeled into the OR. The anesthesiologist hovers over her, and she recognizes her face. It's Dr. Hohenberg. What is she doing here? And then the surgeon turns to her. It's Lee Strasberg.
So they're taking method acting to a whole nother level.
Well, Marilyn realizes she's not really in surgery. She's just in a dream. As her dream self starts going under, Marilyn floats outside her body and watches what happens next. Lee's going to perform surgery on her, and she can tell by the look on everyone's faces that this surgery is special, exciting even. They're about to discover what's inside Marilyn Monroe, whether or not she's actually becoming a true artist. Lee looks supremely confident as he places a scalpel on Marilyn's belly and starts applying pressure. With a steady, even hand, he drags the blade straight up to her sternum. Everyone leans in close. This is the big moment. But as Lee removes the scalpel, he looks pale. Her insides are just sawdust. She's not a brilliant actress. She's not even human. She has as much soul inside her as a Raggedy Ann doll. And now the sawdust won't stop spilling out of her. It spills out onto the operating table, onto the floor, onto Lee's shiny leather shoes. He drops the scalpel and jumps back. Marilyn wakes up in a cold sweat. She can feel her heart racing. It's just a dream, she tells herself. But she can't shake her sense of horror. She's going to let everyone down, she's sure of it. And it's just a matter of time before everyone else discovers that too. From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. In our last episode, Marilyn faced some tough choices. She put her career before her marriage and kicked Joe DiMaggio to the curb. She risked her contract at Fox to start her own production company. And she announced to the world that she wanted to become a serious actor. Now, Marilyn's asking herself if she overpromised, if she's really capable of becoming a true artist. But the question she should be asking herself is, will the cost of making true art be worth it? This is episode 3, Art or Bust. It's 1955. Marilyn's just moved to New York, and she's living at the Waldorf Astoria on Park Avenue. She's determined to turn Suite 278 into her new home. She's even hung a couple pictures of Einstein on the wall and a large portrait of Abraham Lincoln over her bed.
Okay, so is this style mid-century modern or famous white dude chic?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a choice, that's for sure. But Marilyn's in a place of self-examination and introspection. These portraits are inspirational. She admires these men for their contributions to the world. They're the very best in their fields, and that's just what Marilyn aspires to be. But she definitely doesn't feel like she's earned a spot next to them on her wall quite yet. Even though she's been training with Lee 3 times a week, she's only just started coming to sessions at the actor's studio. And unlike her classmates, she refuses to get up on stage. She's only comfortable working with him in private. Strasberg tells her she needs to get up there, but she's terrified. She says no, she's not ready. Marilyn doesn't feel like she's tapped deep enough into her emotions yet. She doesn't think she's as good as her peers.
See, even Marilyn Monroe suffers from imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I hate it. But the way she sees it, they've been training and honing their craft for a while. She can only hope to one day be as good as them. For now, she's just going to keep working at it, practicing and learning from the best instructors in the world, which now includes her new boyfriend, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Arthur Miller. When she met him 4 years ago, sparks flew immediately. Marilyn told a friend that it was a bam moment, like running into a tree, you know, like a cool drink when you've had a fever.
So it's that can't eat, can't sleep, reach for the stars, over the fence, World Series kind of stuff, right?
Preach it. The point is, she finds him incredibly sexy. He's not conventionally attractive. He's tall and lanky. He wears large round-framed glasses and has a sharp nose. One biographer actually describes him as looking Lincoln-esque.
Okay, now the portrait over her bed makes sense. Who doesn't love some good politician role play?
Hillary Clinton. But Marilyn is mostly attracted to his mind. She can listen to him talk for hours. He talks about social issues and what's going on in the world. In his work, he writes about communism and capitalism. He recommends books to Marilyn, like Carl Sandburg's 6-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln.
Okay, does he just like 6-gallon hats or what?
I don't know, but honestly, this is just the best part of the story. And Marilyn devours all of it. The politics, the books. It feels like exactly what she's been missing in Los Angeles. And Arthur also gets big bonus points for being the anti-Joe DiMaggio. For starters, he doesn't hate Hollywood. He's actually in the movie biz. In addition to his novels and stage plays like Death of a Salesman, he writes screenplays too. But most importantly, unlike Joe, he supports her career. He tells her that he believes in her and that she has the potential to be a real artist. And that kind of support is what Marilyn desperately needs. So her relationship with Arthur checks a lot of boxes. Big boxes. Except for one. He's married.
Kind of feels like that's the biggest box.
Yeah. And they have to keep their relationship under wraps. They have private dinners and meetups in her suite. But Marilyn's actually fine with that because even though she can't have him all to herself, she's about to get everything else she's ever wanted. It's December 31st, 1955. Marilyn pops open a bottle of bubbly. She's ringing in the new year and her new contract. After a full year of not working and making a single film, 20th Century Fox has offered her a 7-year deal. Here are the terms. She's allowed to make films under her new company, Marilyn Monroe Productions. Over the 7 years, she only has to make 4 films for the studio. She'll get a salary of $100,000 for each of those films and $500 a week for expenses, which would make this 29-year-old the highest-paid actress in the world. And finally, she gets approval over the director and cinematographer and the story.
Okay, I'm saying it. The ghost of Marilyn should be our agent.
No way, she'd get all of our roles.
Okay, but I have to know, what's going on with Zanuck? Like, is he tied up and blindfolded in a small room in her basement right now?
Well, her last movie, The 7-Year Itch, the one where the wind blew up her skirt, made $12 million, which is $127 million in 2022 money. And the reviews were incredible. Hedda Hopper called The 7-Year Itch Marilyn's first great picture. Variety called it the hottest ticket of the summer. Marilyn's proven over and over what a powerhouse she is. Zanuck had no choice but to give in. She beat him again. But unlike last time, she feels good about signing this deal. She doesn't feel like she's being manipulated or conceding anything. She got everything she asked for and more. She's also about to get some revenge. In the following days, the press does a complete 180. They go from mocking her moxie and making fun of her aspirations to celebrating her victory. She's no longer being called stupid or being reprimanded for taking stupid advice.
And that's not just because they found a thesaurus.
Right. Newspapers cover this latest turn of events with headlines like "Battle with Studio Won by Marilyn" and "Actress Wins All Demands." Time magazine reports, "There is persuasive evidence that Marilyn Monroe is a shrewd businesswoman."
Gotta love these clout-chasing journalists.
The new year is really shaping up. Marilyn's production company isn't just a dream anymore. It's going to actually happen. Now she just needs to find her first film to produce and star in. Something that shows the world what this new Marilyn is really capable of. It's 1956. Marilyn is with her producing partner, Milton Green, at the Music Box Theater on Broadway. She keeps her head down as they quickly walk upstairs toward their balcony seats. She's scouting Broadway plays to find her next role, something she can adapt with Fox. And she thinks this play might be just what she's looking for. Bus stops about a jaded saloon singer named Cherie, who's trying to outrun her abusive past and take herself to Hollywood. The actress playing Cherie, Kim Stanley, is garnering a ton of praise, and so is the play. Everyone's talking Tony nominations. This could be exactly the role Marilyn's been looking for. A role with real substance that Marilyn can use her own life experience to deepen. It's a method actor's dream come true. She turns to Milton and shows him her arm. "Look, I have goosebumps and the show hasn't even started yet." The lights start to flicker and the curtain goes up. Marilyn watches as Kim, who's also a student of Lee's and a regular at the actor's studio, turns herself into Cherie. She watches as Kim makes the audience laugh, makes them cry. The audience hangs on her every word. By the time it's intermission, Marilyn goes from being excited about playing Cherie to being almost dizzy with fear. She can't compete with Kim, a trained Broadway actress. What was she thinking? Marilyn leans in close to Milton. "They should just let her do the movie because she is Cherie." Milton looks at her in disbelief. This is the part she's been waiting for. But Marilyn shakes her head. "There's no way I can even be half that good." Milton barely convinces her to stay for the rest of the show. When Marilyn goes home, she can't stop thinking about Kim's performance and how she'll never be able to stack up. But Milton drags Marilyn back 3 more times to see the play. And every time she does, she starts to let herself dream a little more about what it would feel like to play the part. She begins to think about what she can bring to the character. She understands Cherie's deep need for respect and her dreams of Hollywood. And then it hits her just how badly she wants to play her. She just needs to prove to herself, once and for all, that she's good enough to. It's February 17th, 1956. Marilyn's at the actor's studio, in the one room she's never been in before, the dressing room. That's because today, she's finally agreed to perform in front of Lee's class. Lee has been begging her to for months, but she always said no. But today, it's time to put her talent to the test. She's going to discover whether she's an artist or a fraud. Marilyn peeks out the door into the classroom. It's packed. She hears two students in the front row whispering. Do you know what she's performing? Eugene O'Neill's Anna Christie. Oh man, Greta Garbo's role? Why would you want anyone to compare you to Garbo? Hearing that, Marilyn almost blacks out with nerves. But she reminds herself that she chose this scene for a reason. If she's going to prove to herself that she's an actress, she's not going to take the easy way out. Lee pops his head in. It's time. Marilyn nods. She tries not to black out as she puts one foot in front of the other. Again and again until she's on stage. She reminds herself she's not Marilyn anymore. She's Anna, a broken-down woman running from her secret past as a prostitute. This isn't a stage, it's a saloon. She runs her finger across the table. Sawdust. She lets herself feel everything that Anna is feeling in this moment. Exhaustion, depression, anxiety. She slumps into the chair and looks up at the bartender.
Give me a whiskey. Ginger ale on the side. And don't be stingy, baby.
As she lifts the glass to her mouth, her hand trembles. Marilyn doesn't know where she begins and Anna ends. Anna's about to meet the father who abandoned her. And Marilyn knows exactly what Anna's feeling. She wipes her mouth and turns to another patron at the bar.
It's my old man I gotta meet. I ain't seen him since I was a kid. Don't even know what he looks like. I ain't expecting much from him. Give you a kick when you're down. That's what all men do.
As the scene unfolds, Marilyn gets deeper and deeper into the zone. She doesn't notice her classmates leaning forward in their seats. She can't hear how everyone in the room is holding their breath as if a spell is being cast and they don't want to break it. But when the scene finishes, she hears the applause. The whole room is standing up. Lee's class has a strict no clapping rule, but for the first time ever, nobody cares. Marilyn barely registers what's happening. She's still half lost in the character. But there near the front is Kim Stanley, the actor who plays Cherie on Broadway. And Kim is clapping loudest of all. Marilyn takes a bow. And then, when the clapping doesn't stop, she takes another. She's already thinking about all the things she could have done better. But it doesn't matter. She knows it's finally time to move forward by going back to Hollywood. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And yeah. So mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. It's 1956. Marilyn's done with fall, winter, and spring. She's back to where it's perpetually summer, Los Angeles.
Marilyn's also back at Fox, but this time she's wearing two hats, star and producer. She fought hard for that title, so now she better prove that she deserves it. She throws herself into pre-production for Bus Stop. First things first, find the director. Marilyn gives the studio a short list of who she likes. At the very top of her list is Joshua Logan. He's renowned on Broadway, where he directed and co-wrote South Pacific. It earned him both a Tony Award and a Pulitzer Prize. He's now making a name for himself in film. Fox reaches out to Logan, and when he hears they want to adapt Bus Stop, he's like, yes. But when they say Marilyn will be playing the lead, he's like, no. He point blank tells Fox he won't do it because Marilyn can't act.
So then I assume he doesn't know what acting is.
He must not. Fox relays the message to Marilyn, but Marilyn's not in the mood to doubt herself. Not today. So she calls Logan up and convinces him to meet with her. Over dinner, she tells him how she's been studying method acting. In fact, Lee's wife Paula is going to be her acting coach for the film. Logan's intrigued. And then, right as Logan begins to soften, Marilyn slides into a southern drawl. Marilyn's confidence is growing, and she's discovered she actually has a talent for accents.
Yet another thing we have in common.
Yeah, she modeled her southern one after your Australian.
Mm-hmm.
But Logan is impressed. Marilyn goes on to say that she's committed to making Cherie as real as possible. She's going to make herself look as rough as she needs to. She's going to walk so Charlize Theron and Monster can run. My words, of course, not hers. And it works. By the end of dinner, he's on board. He calls up Fox and says yes. He also adds that Marilyn's much brighter than he'd imagined.
It's probably from all the light bulbs she's been eating.
Mm-hmm. But Marilyn gets her yes. It's her first big win as a producer, and she's determined to not make it her last. Next on Marilyn's mile-long to-do list is the film's wardrobe. Fortunately, she's working with William Trevilla, the same costume designer who made the strapless pink gown she wore in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and the white halter dress she wore in The 7 Year Itch.
Okay, someone needs to get this guy a full scholarship to fit him stat.
Seriously, Heidi could never. And Marilyn knows she's in good hands. Today, Trevilla's showing her a new piece he's cooked up for Cherie. When he unzips the garment bag, Marilyn sees a beautiful showgirl number that he hand-stitched himself. It's a jade green corset covered in sequins that gleam like fish scales. And it's perfect. Too perfect.
I love it, William. But, she hesitates. Would you mind if I made a few adjustments?
All he can do is nod, confused. Marilyn takes the garment and plops down on the floor with it. And before he can intervene, she begins tearing sequins off the corset like she's descaling a fish. And then she rips holes into the matching stockings. Next, she asks for a needle and thread. The stunned costume designer hands it to her. She begins to sew the costume back together, haphazardly, just like Cherie herself would. Cherie needs to be wearing something that's had as hard a life as she's had. Something that's been torn and put back together over and over again. When she's done, Marilyn holds up the once beautiful, now sad garment to William and says, This is what Cherie would wear. And even William has to admit, now it's perfect. Marilyn's next stop is the makeup department. Cherie sleeps during the day and doesn't go to bed again until after her last performance at the crack of dawn. And Marilyn wants to honor that. She doesn't want to look healthy and vibrant. She wants to look paler than usual, even if it undercuts her own beauty.
Okay, so she's Team Edward.
Obviously. So Marilyn teams up with her makeup artist to find the right look. They apply white cornstarch to her face until she looks as sun-deprived as Cherie would. And then she works with her hairstylist to tone down her platinum locks. She needs a cheaper shade of blonde for this part. The key word here is realism. And Marilyn's perfectionism is coming in handy. She's getting all the details right. All the small little things that other people might overlook, but ultimately set good art apart. It turns out Marilyn's a natural producer. Now she just needs to make sure she brings that same attention to detail to her performance. On March 15th,
1956, shooting begins. And everything about Marilyn's look is ready for set. Her hair's the right shade of blonde, her skin's the right shade of pale, and her costume is just the right degree of tacky. But while Marilyn's look is camera ready, Marilyn herself is not. She spent the past year training for this moment, learning how to coax the most realistic performances out of herself. But that also means she's become harder on herself than ever. Her standards are so much higher than they were the last time she was on a film set. And even back then, they were ridiculously high.
I mean, that's why I deleted all my dating apps.
Mm-hmm. That's why you gotta kiss yourself in the mirror. No one compares.
True.
But the more Marilyn thinks about what she wants to achieve today, the harder it becomes to breathe. Her makeup artist watches as Marilyn's perfectly powdered skin starts to break out in hives. Her makeup artist spackles on more foundation and powder until the redness almost disappears. And Marilyn tries to talk herself down in her perfect Southern drawl, reminding herself she is Cherie. She can do this. And when she finally gets to set, and Logan, the director, finally calls action, Marilyn proves she can. Her performance is rich and deep and nuanced. It's immediately apparent to everyone there that all of Marilyn's hard work over the past year, the acting lessons, and the therapy, has paid off in spades. When Logan calls cut at the end of the scene, everyone applauds. But Marilyn thinks she can do even better. She tells Logan she wants to do the scene again. And then she asks to do it again, and again, and again.
Wait, are we talking about Marilyn or our senior producer?
Well, she asks to do the scene over 30 times, so definitely our senior producer. She does it until she's literally exhausted herself. And she continues to demand take after take during every scene throughout the whole shoot. Method acting has made Marilyn a better actor, but also a more insecure one. Simple scenes swallow up entire days. The rest of the cast and crew quickly go from being delighted by Marilyn's high standards to resenting them. And Marilyn is spinning out of control, too. She takes more and more sleeping pills to get to bed every night. And some nights, they don't even work. On those nights, she calls Arthur Miller and cries into the phone. I can't do it. I can't work this way. I'm no trained actor.
Oh my God, she's so hard on herself.
Too hard on herself. And I'm not sure what Arthur says, but he does talk her off the ledge. She goes back to set every morning and the cycle continues. Take after take during the day, and then handfuls of sleeping pills or frantic phone calls every night. By the time it wraps, Marilyn's a mess. Her first attempt at method acting on film has been pure torture for herself and everyone around her. Now all she can do is hope that all the pain and suffering turned into some damn good art. In the summer of 1956, Bus Stop premieres and Marilyn holds her breath. She's so fragile, she's not sure she can take any negative reviews. But it turns out, she doesn't have to. A reviewer for the New York Times writes, "Hold on to your chairs, everybody, and get set for a rattling surprise. Marilyn Monroe has finally proved herself an actress." And the praise keeps coming. Another critic writes, "Monroe creates a complete and deeply moving character." The director, Logan, tells reporters that Marilyn might be one of the most talented actresses who's ever lived. He describes her as an impossible combination of Greta Garbo and Charlie Chaplin.
You know, people describe us as an impossible combination of Fergie and Jesus.
Even the rich go to the Catalina wine mixer. To this day, film historians think Bus Stop is Marilyn's finest work. And it pulls in good numbers, too. It ends up making $7 million, which would be about $75 million today. It's not as much as her previous film, The Seven-Year Itch, but it's still a huge box office hit. Marilyn's finally proven herself as an actress and a producer. For the first time in her career, she's getting the respect she deserves. She knows exactly which project she wants to work on next and which director she wants to work with. Everything's coming into focus. Or almost everything. Her doubts about whether or not she's a true artist have temporarily been quieted. But her doubts about her love life, those are just getting started. It's a summer afternoon in June of 1956 in Westchester, New York. Marilyn zips up a champagne-colored dress. It's T-length and fits tightly over her curves. It's the only wedding dress she's ever felt like herself in. But she's not sure she's making the right choice marrying Arthur.
That'll be a cozy relationship. Marilyn, Arthur, Arthur's wife.
Well, while she was filming Bus Stop, he was filing for divorce. And before the ink was even dry, he proposed to Marilyn, and she said yes. But now that she's in her wedding dress and can hear the wedding guests assembling downstairs, she's starting to have doubts.
Well, if Sex and the City taught me anything, it's that you shouldn't worry about your doubts until the day of the wedding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, looking into a mirror, for sure. And now Marilyn's finally asking herself, is their relationship really built to last? Arthur's the most brilliant man she knows. She loves listening to him talk about literature and politics, but she feels like his student, not his partner. His lectures never turn into two-way conversations. Everything's so lopsided between them. His brilliance turns her on, but it also makes her feel so insecure.
So many red flags here.
Mm-hmm. And she's starting to realize that her past makes him insecure. He hates the idea that she's been with other men. Arthur's nothing like Joe, who wanted her to cover up and stop being sexy in public. But Arthur is jealous too, just beneath the surface, and it scares her. Milton pops his head into the room. "You ready?" he asks. And then he sees the look on Marilyn's face. "What is it?" Marilyn shakes her head. "Tell me you don't want me to do it, and I won't do it," she says. Milton's shocked. He can't make that decision for her, but he tells her that if she wants to leave, he'll get the car and get her out of here, right now.
Okay, see, now everyone should have a Milton in their friend group.
Agree. And Marilyn nods okay. Milton kicks it into high gear. He grabs a big bag and starts throwing in makeup, toiletries, clothes. But Marilyn doesn't move to help. She's frozen on the bed. A slideshow of Arthur, past and present, flicks by in her head. There he is, cradling the phone as he helps her get through those long, sleepless nights on Bus Stop. And there he is next to her in bed, sharing his favorite passages from a Dostoevsky novel. He looks at her adoringly, and she hangs on every word. And there he is, heartbroken, humiliated, and confused because she's left him at the altar. She reaches out and grabs Milton's arm. "Stop." She can't do that to Arthur. Marilyn rolls her shoulders and stands up straight. She smooths out her dress and pats her eyes with a handkerchief. She hadn't realized she'd been crying. And then she smiles, tentatively at first, and then with more determination. She's going to play the happy bride today. She takes Milton's arm and they walk downstairs. The guests cheer as she enters the living room. That evening, no one but Milton knows that Marilyn's only acting. She beams at Arthur as she says, "I do." She hangs on her husband's arm and feeds him cake. She smiles until her cheeks hurt for the wedding portrait. A few days later, when the portrait's been processed and mailed to her, she turns it over and writes one word three times over on the back. Hope, hope, hope.
When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
And I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
My God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com.
We know you have your tried and true closet staples, but it can be fun to switch it up. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada.
Yeah, it's easy to find instant inspiration at Saks.com. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch.
Okay, well, obviously this is making me just want to shop after we record this.
I know, and it doesn't take much for me wanting to shop.
No.
So. But if you're looking for a joyful shopping escape, which we all are,
yes,
then head to Saks.com for inspiring ways to shop for everything on your agenda.
Saks.com.
Two weeks after their wedding, Marilyn and Arthur take off for London. And life feels pretty good. She has her new husband in the seat beside her, and she's on her way to produce and star in a new movie.
Okay, has this girl learned nothing from her last honeymoon/work trip?
Apparently not, but this project was on her calendar long before Arthur proposed to her. It's called The Prince and the Showgirl. Ever since she saw the stage play Sleeping Prince, she's been wanting to turn it into a film. In fact, the very first thing she did after Marilyn Monroe Productions was up and running was buy the rights to it. She even negotiated with the writer herself. This film is going to be all hers. She's going to put her heart and soul in it. She even handpicked her director/co-star, and I'm sure you've heard of him, Sir Laurence Olivier. He's probably done more Shakespeare than Shakespeare himself. No actor is taken more seriously, and Marilyn's become such a force in Hollywood that she was able to get him. Marilyn looks out over the Atlantic and thinks maybe she can have everything after all. The brilliant husband. Maybe, down the road, a family of her own. And the career of her dreams. It's July 30th, 1956. Marilyn is quickly walking across a soundstage. Today's the first day of rehearsals for The Prince and the Showgirl, and everything's exactly how she imagined it. She sees two men moving in a purple couch that she picked out, and another man places a tasseled lamp on a side table she selected. It's like her vision is coming to life right before her eyes. Now she just needs to find where the cast and crew have assembled. She knows the Fox lot like the back of her hand, but Pinewood Studios is all new to her. She wanders into one soundstage, then another. Where is everyone? Then, in the distance, she hears some men laughing. One of them sounds a lot like Olivier. She follows the sound until she spots a large group of crewmen and actors. In the middle of them is Olivier holding court. Marilyn takes in the scene. Olivier's clearly at home. He knows Pinewood Studios as well as she knows Fox. And he's filled the crew with people he's worked with before. None of these people, though, have ever worked with her. She suddenly feels like the new girl entering school mid-semester.
Uh-oh.
A wave of nausea washes over her. But Marilyn tries to shake it off. She'll win them over with the speech she's planned. As executive producer, she wants to set the tone for the whole shoot. It should be a pleasant and nurturing environment. But before she can get a word out, Olivier takes her hand and leads her into the group.
Oh, look who it is. It's Marilyn. We're so pleased to have such a delightful little thing among us.
Okay, calm down, Lawrence.
Marilyn's entire speech evaporates into vapors of rage. And it gets even worse. Olivier tells everyone that they must be patient with their guest, and it might take their Hollywood visitor some time to learn their method.
Okay, what the fuck is that even supposed to mean?
He's trying to throw shade on method acting. Marilyn didn't realize it when she brought him onto the project, but Olivier hates Strasberg's technique with a passion. He thinks it slows down the process. Actors become so consumed with finding the right memories and the right feelings that they totally forget about the actual scene they're performing. He believes in the old-school method of pretending. He's more, learn your lines and don't bump into the furniture. Marilyn's seething at this point, but everyone's watching her. So she forces herself to smile and say something about how happy she is to be there. But inside, she's the opposite of happy. She's thinking,
If this is day one, what's the rest of the shoot going to be like? Marilyn soon learns it's not going to get any better. In fact, it's going to get a hell of a lot worse. When shooting starts, Marilyn starts to suffer from the same anxiety she had on bus stop. She gets hives. She refuses to come out of her dressing room until she feels ready. And every time she slows down production, Olivier loses his mind. Instead of passive-aggressively mocking method acting, he now openly condemns it. And the more angry he gets, the more Marilyn shuts down. It's like a vicious cycle. Things completely deteriorate one day when Marilyn requests another take. She wants to get her performance just right, but Olivier's had enough. He sneers at her. All you have to do is be sexy, dear Marilyn.
Okay, this lint liquor needs to fucking chill.
Marilyn runs off set. She's devastated. He hit a big nerve. She thought she was past proving she was more than just a pretty face. But with just one sentence, Olivier's made her feel like she'll never be his equal. He'll never see her as an artist. Maybe no one ever will. Marilyn is a complete wreck. Her previous anxiety and fears are nothing compared to the dread and apprehension she's feeling now. And there's only one way she knows how to deal with them. Marilyn turns to alcohol and pills. Without them, she can't sleep at all. After a day of work, she comes home full of anger, frustration, and mistrust. She goes on tirades to Arthur, telling him how awful Olivier is and how she has no allies on set. She feels like she's all alone, and it's torture.
So another bad honeymoon for this girl.
Seriously. Arthur listens to Marilyn's grievances, but there's nothing he can say or do to help. The only thing that seems to give her any comfort are her pills and alcohol. Everyone knows she's spinning out of control, but nobody knows how to stop her. They just kind of dance around her. Her costume designer makes the same white dress for Marilyn in three different sizes because she knows Marilyn's size goes up and down depending on how much she's been drinking. Marilyn is spiraling, and just when it seems like things can't get any worse, they do. It's midday, August 28th, 1956 in London. Marilyn's waking up. She's groggy from the champagne and the pills she took the night before. But she has a scene to shoot later, so she better pull herself together and go over her lines. She reaches for her script on the bedside table. It's not there. Marilyn thinks, where did I leave it last? Arthur's office. Marilyn throws off the sheets and slips on her robe. She walks down the stairs and into her husband's writing room. Books are strewn everywhere. A typewriter sits on the desk. Marilyn pauses and takes it in. It's like she's wandered inside his mind. It's so comforting being in here. Marilyn had her doubts about marrying him, but now she has no regrets. She doesn't know how she'd survive this nightmare without him. Marilyn breaks out of her trance. She scans the room for her script. There it is. As she reaches for it, she sees a little notebook on his desk. It's where Arthur writes all his thoughts and ideas. Sometimes he writes snippets of dialogue and titles for new plays. He usually keeps it on him. She's never seen him leave it behind before. And today, Arthur's even left it open. Would it be so bad if she just took a little look? Marilyn takes the book in her hands and reads the first two words. So disappointed. Marilyn nearly drops the notebook. Is Arthur talking about her? She continues reading. I thought I'd married an angel, but she's an out-of-control child.
Okay, any chance he's talking about his ex-wife?
Possibly, but Marilyn reads on. Arthur worries that this marriage is going to end even more badly than his last. Marilyn's constant emotional demands keep taking him away from his own creative work. She's selfish and exhausting. He writes that maybe Laurence Olivier was right when he called her a troublesome bitch. Marilyn starts to reel. She reads these words over and over again. Each time, another layer of her world's foundation crumbles. When she arrived in London just a few weeks ago, she thought she was turning a new leaf. She had a new film to throw herself into, and a new husband to love with her entire heart. And now what does she have? Tears stream down her face. Everyone in the world looks at her and thinks she has it all. She's Marilyn Monroe. But she doesn't feel anything like Marilyn. She feels like Norma Jean, young, helpless, and abandoned. It was always the moments she finally felt at home that her new home was taken from her. Marilyn sits rocking on the floor, clutching Arthur's diary. She can't stand being this unhappy. Something needs to change. She doesn't know what it is, but it needs to be something big. And it needs to happen soon, or else Marilyn feels like she's gonna lose it all.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This is episode 3 of our 4-part series, Marilyn. We use a lot of sources when researching our stories, like Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon by Charles Casillo, Marilyn Monroe by Barbara Leeming, The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe by Donald Wolfe, and The Secret Life of Marilyn Monroe by J. Randy Taraborelli. I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore Williams. Dennis Hensley wrote this episode. It was edited by Allison Reimer. Kate Young is our producer. Our senior producers are Natalie Shisha and Ben Gray. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design by Sam Ada. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture themed trophies for 6 basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.